This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Occupation, Book 1 in The Rise series. Written by Devin C. Ford and Nathan Heistad. Performed by Ray Porter. Prologue. Tom. The rumble of the hover car's engines rang loudly through the valley. Tom pressed his body against the thick base of the massive cottonwood tree. The ridge he stood on ran for 300 yards, the drop descending at least twice that distance to the base of the mountain. From here he could usually see for miles, but not today, since the rolling, dense clouds brought a looming storm with them, reducing visibility. He didn't need to see the hover car to know it was there. Too close to their base. Too close to finding their hidden location. Tom scratched his silver beard and slipped a tablet from his pack, activating it from sleep mode. With two practiced swipes, a map materialized, revealing the location of nearby occupation assets. Five seekers hovered in the skies around Cripple Creek, not close enough for him to panic quite yet, but close enough for him to be concerned. Things were changing. After all these years, the occupation was evolving. He sniffed the air as if he could smell the alterations in the enemy's objectives. Instead, the scent of ozone filled his nostrils as rain began falling from the sky. He stayed under the semi-reprieve of the tree line, watching, waiting. For what? He wasn't sure. The map blinked another icon, this one green, the color for a tracker. He frowned at the small icon, a mixture of fear and a burning anger at their enemy's superiority. The tracker hovered around the 5-mile boundary of their base, pausing before moving again. It wasn't unusual for one to migrate through this part of what had once been the Midwest, but it was the third cataloged this week, and Tom didn't like what this might portend. He'd made a promise a long time ago and still felt the weight of his failure almost every day. With a heavy heart, the man turned, satisfied there was no impending attack, at least not today. A twig snapped behind him, and he spun, his 9mm in his grip faster than the eye could see.
"Sir, it's me,"
a woman in camouflage similar to his own said quietly, her arms raised in the air.
"Bailey. What is it?"
he asked. Annoyed, she sought him out in person instead of using the radio. She seemed nervous.
"We have confirmation. They're moving in this week."
She flashed him a smile. He met it with a grin of his own. They'd been working for so long, fighting back in small ways. Finally, they were going to make the first real strike. He was going to fulfill that promise after all.
"Very good."
Tom glanced over the valley, knowing he'd return tomorrow at the same time, just like every other day. Rain poured down on the two of them as they hiked through the dense brush toward their home.
Home?
The man almost chuckled at his thought. Maybe one day they'd have a home again, but first they'd have to reclaim what was theirs. 1. Cole's eyes snapped open, his mind electrified by the faintest hint of a noise his brain was acutely attuned to. His life depended on it. The sharp whine of the deadly drones, like mosquitoes in summer, vibrated the small bones in his ear according to the scorched remains of the medical children's book he'd been reading for the last few nights. He sat up slowly, bending at the waist and swinging his feet off the old, grimy couch he'd called his bed for nearly 2 weeks. He reached down, quickly tightening the laces of his boots, which he'd loosened as his only concession to comfort. He stood, stretching his arms upwards as far as he could reach, with the shotgun held firmly in both hands, leaning forward to touch the gun to his toes before twisting sideways to articulate his hips. Fully awake and flexed, he threw his heavy pack over one shoulder and draped the bandolier of red shells across his torso. He screwed the cap on his battered canteen and stuffed it into a leg pocket of his threadbare cargo pants before stooping above the map laid out on the dusty kitchen counter. Cole muttered to himself. His eyes weren't as good as they'd been a couple of years before, and having to all but press his nose into the map was troublesome.
"Truth or consequences," he muttered to himself, stumbling through the four consecutive syllables of the last word in spite of the time he spent reading.
He huffed to himself at the name of the town, running his finger to the east on the map.
"Too far," he said to himself. "Too hot to be away from the river."
He ran his finger to the nearest town, to the isolated house he'd been living in, narrowing his position from the few remaining road signs and the shape of the river that couldn't have changed too drastically in the course of his lifetime. He did the same to the west, fussing again as it meant crossing the river within a very tight time frame. He chewed his crusted lower lip for a second before stabbing a red circle daubed on the green patch. Folding the map quickly, he stuffed it away and shrugged his arm through the bag straps before carefully sliding open the rear porch doors. He slipped out of the house without a backwards glance. The whine sound was louder now as the drone headed in his direction, and it spurred his feet to move. Cole looked up, turning to place the morning sun on his right, and he began to run. He stopped after a quarter mile, resting under the sparse cover of a copse of trees, and pulled the broken but valuable contraption from a pocket on the side of his pack. Lifting half a set of binoculars to his right eye, he found the rear of the house he'd been living in and caught the glint of bright silver as the smooth, bulbous body of the seeker drone hovered around the patio door. Cole's lips mouthed the word, "Damn it," having learned the hard way how well the drones could hear from far distances. He knew he should have closed the door because they'd be inside soon and would know a human had been there when none of their ID tags showed an authorized presence. The drone darted upward and to the right so fast that it mimicked the natural behavior of a housefly as it was joined by a second seeker. Cole stiffened, forcing his breathing to stay steady. If there was more than one seeker drone, there was likely to be a pack of tracker drones not far behind. If there were seekers and trackers, a hunter might follow. If there weren't, then it could be them coming for him. He had to keep moving. Stepping backwards without looking, his boot caught a patch of dead leaves and rustled loudly. The whine changed in pitch as the two seeker drones were joined by a third. They spread out into a line, heading straight for him. He ran. No attempt to move stealthily or slowly to avoid detection, because there was no way they would pass him by if he hid. They'd find him if he remained still. And if they thought they were onto a wild human, they wouldn't stop until they located him. He didn't want the seeker drones shooting him with sedative darts, and he didn't want the trackers tearing him apart with their mechanical pincers. He certainly didn't want them to rain fire down from their ships and scorch the whole town he was hiding in, which he'd seen them do in the past. His only hope for survival lay in either outrunning the seekers or destroying them.
"Three,"
he thought to himself as he ran.
"Only three. You can handle three."
Cole ran toward the only buildings ahead of him, angling from the narrow gap between two broken-down houses. He hurdled a flaking, once-white wooden fence and forced his way through the mess of rusted bikes and trash cans until he reached the rear of the houses. He threw himself against the wall as he held the shotgun against his chest, sucking in deep breaths to steady himself.
"One, two, three. One, two, three."
The whine of the drones grew louder, changing pitch as the first entered the narrow gap. He stepped around the corner and lifted the shotgun up to trigger off the first instinctive shot and obliterate the lead drone.
"One," he whispered, allowing himself a slight grin. Behind the falling, sparking shards of the destroyed Seeker, a second flew at him, fast. He racked the pump of the old but well-maintained weapon to chamber another shell as the smoking, spent casing spun out of the ejection port. A twitch of the barrel adjusted the aim to blot out the sight of the attacking machine, and a second pull of the trigger turned the shiny flying ball into shrapnel.
Two,
he said, scanning left and right, desperately searching for the third one. He could hear it, and he wanted to kill the Seeker before it realized it was at risk. A sharp buzz to his left made him spin to trigger off a third shot, which blew away a chunk of roof. He began to say until he realized that the whine was still there. The Seeker had taken cover before he could shoot. Cole racked the gun to replenish the spent shell and ran. The third Seeker would be flying higher now, following programming to get out of range and call in reinforcements.
Didn't get the third, he repeated a few times. Tracker's coming. Tracker's coming.
Cole sprinted until the noise of the drone had gone and carried on for longer to make sure he was away. The trackers wouldn't be far behind, another hour at most, but when they arrived, they'd follow him relentlessly. They didn't need to sleep, didn't need to stop and eat, didn't need to find fresh water and carry it with them. He'd never seen one run out of charge, and he thought of the solar panels he'd seen once, recalling the old man's claim that he'd pulled them from the wrecked carcass of a tracker drone.
Just run, he told himself. Cross the river, change direction, and run.
2. Alec. Sweat poured down Alec's face as he pressed the metal sheet against the half-hidden structure. Another man used a large rivet gun, holding it into place before the welder took his position. Alec covered the joints with flux and stepped out of the way as the wide-shouldered masked man started his torch. He'd worked in this plant for 10 agonizing years, and this was the first time he'd seen the curtains come up. Most of whatever it was they were constructing was sheltered by long, draping canvas sheets, and only the parts being worked on currently were exposed. The change made him uncomfortable, even more so than usual. The constant gnawing in his gut turned to real pain when he arrived before the sun rose to announce the day, and saw the overnight modifications.
What is it?
Alex asked the welder when he was done. The man flipped up his mask and grimaced.
Who cares?
He replied gruffly before walking the line, looking for the next seam to weld.
You!
A voice carried across the plant floor, and Alec shuddered.
Oh, crap,
he muttered to himself. He couldn't afford any more altercations with the floor supervisors. He turned to see the balding worm approaching.
What are you doing? Talking during your shift, standing here like a lost puppy? Get to work or it's your ass,
Simon shouted. Alec hated the man with every ounce of his being. He stood 3 feet away, and Alec fought the urge to clench his fist, to throttle the scrawny-necked traitor. Instead, he forced a smile.
Sorry, sir, I noticed we were running low on rivets and wanted to see if we could obtain a refill.
The lie was simple enough. The man would have to buy it. He looked at Alec suspiciously, peering over his shoulder to see their workstation.
Fine, but today's nearly done. We'll pick it up tomorrow.
Alec let out a tense sigh as Simon walked away, scanning his tablet before yelling toward another group of workers. Workers, they could call them that, but Alec preferred to think of them as what they truly were. Slaves. The entire floor echoed with a piercing alarm. No matter how many times Alec heard the shift-ending notification, he couldn't help but feel terror at the dreadful sound. It was the same noise they used when they were on the search for roamers in the city. Without realizing it, Alec rubbed his wrist where his locator chip was implanted under his skin. The alarm ceased, and Alec got in line with the other 200 slaves in the old car assembly plant. No one spoke, let alone gave each other eye contact. They were beaten. There was no coming back for any of them. When it was his turn to walk through the turnstiles, he stretched his hand out for the metal chit. The glossy-eyed woman reached for a full chit, but Simon was there, shaking his finger a moment later.
"Not for this one. He gets a half chit only," Simon said, grinning at Alec.
The little man took pleasure in his minuscule, appointed power, but still, Alec was hungry and he couldn't argue, or he'd get nothing.
"Thank you, sir. I'll be better tomorrow," Alec said, hating himself with a passion.
"That's more like it,"
Simon said, handing him the half chit. It was a cut coin, an old penny, from a world that had ceased to exist. Alec forced his feet onward, wiping his dirty hands on the pants of his overalls before he arrived at the mess hall. He stayed in line, scanning for Beth at the tables. It took a few times, but he spotted her, by herself at the far right table, staring down at her plate of bland oats. Seeing her made it all worth it. Someone shoved him from behind, and he locked eyes with the welder.
"Move it,"
the man said, and Alec forged ahead, broken from his reverie. He passed his cut coin to the middle-aged woman behind the glass and was handed a small serving of gray gruel in return. He smiled at her, knowing he'd received nothing but a blank stare in response. A moment later, Alec was sitting in the cold plastic chair opposite Beth.
"Tough day?"
he asked.
"Better than the alternatives," she said.
He knew what those were. For women, it was either work in the plants, making God knows what for the bastards, or being sent to the breeding facilities. The third alternative was death, which was preferable for a lot of people.
"I hear you," he said.
Beth stared at him, her one green and one brown eye boring into his. It was enough of a genetic defect that she hadn't been sent to the breeding grounds, and little enough of one that she was allowed to live. Lucky girl.
"How do you do it?"
she asked, glancing at his small serving of the tasteless mush.
"Do what? Go on. This is never going to change. You need to admit that, and then you can move on."
She was whispering, keeping their conversation private. Most of the other tables were full of people eating voraciously and silent. Three human supervisors walked between the tables, guns in hand. Alec hated those people most of all, the ones who chose to side with them. If he had a gun, he'd...
"Look, there's always a better life. It's up to us to find it," he said, only half believing his own words.
"Sure. Look me up when you arrive."
Beth spooned the last of her dinner into her mouth and ran a hand over her recently shorn head. It was the same haircut they all had. Once a month, the supervisors shaved their heads, and Alec didn't mind it. It was all he'd ever known. He leaned in, pretending he'd dropped something in the middle of the table.
"I'm going tonight."
Her eyes widened.
"Why?"
"I need to. I can't. I need to. Come with me."
She shook her head.
"No, it's too risky. When I leave next, it's going to be for real."
"For real?" He was about to ask her what she meant when the alarm rang out again, indicating dinner was complete. He ate the last of his meager serving and stood. He moved close to her in line.
"We'll talk about that tomorrow, okay?"
She nodded without turning or saying anything more. 20 minutes later, Alec was inside his bunk. As the door closed, he slid a piece of cardboard between the latch and frame before the electronic locks slid into place. He stared out of the tiny barred window at the grassy view that stretched out behind the manufacturing plant. There was so much out there, so much empty space. There had to be others who wanted freedom from this oppression. He waited 2 hours until everyone would be fast asleep, exhausted from the 12-hour shift, before he opened his bunk door slowly and carefully so the hinges didn't alert anyone of his escape. He picked up the piece of cardboard and stepped into the hall, glancing at his wrist, where the locator was embedded into his bones. He'd almost forgotten the most important part. He could have been killed within a few minutes without it. Alec pulled the metallic strip from under his mattress and wrapped it around his wrist, clicking it into place. It vibrated slightly, somehow blocking the signal of his locator. He tried not to think of Tom's expression on the plant floor the last time he'd seen him. One day he was there, the next he'd vanished into thin air. Tom had acted like a father to him even though he'd only been there for a year or so. Now he was most likely dead. But Tom had left a few presents behind for Alec, and for that he'd be eternally grateful. He scanned the darkness for signs of guards, but the halls were empty. The Seekers would be in the skies, but no one had escaped from the plant for at least 3 years. The Overseers were either growing complacent or they were concentrating on other things. A few tense minutes later, Alec was in the grassy field running through the fresh night air. At that moment, he felt free, and he clung to it. If they found him now, he'd be killed, but part of him was at peace with that. At least he didn't give in to them like everyone else. He knew this path like the back of his hand and checked his wrist as he neared the edge of the field, making sure the ID chip blocker was still intact. It wasn't foolproof, but something in the band messed with their sensors, or that was what Tom had told him. So far, it had worked like a charm. A wooden barbed wire fence ran along the property line, and he hopped the 4 feet, vaulting his legs over the log beam, landing softly on the gravel road beyond. With a glance to the skies, Alec moved to the opposite ditch and headed north. 10 minutes later, Alec arrived at his destination out of breath. Sweat dripped down his back in the cool night air as he entered the abandoned building. The street was full of derelict warehouses, and Alec knew this had once been a thriving commercial region of Detroit. Now it was home to rats and not much else. The side door creaked as Alec pulled it open, and he darted inside the safety of the structure. Boxes sat piled high on pallets from a lifetime ago. This had once been a ball-bearing distributor, and the entire warehouse room had the lingering smell of grease to it. A sliver of moonlight slipped through a skylight and lit his way to the office at the rear of the floor. For the first time in the last month, Alec felt happiness creep into his mind. This was his haven. He found the flashlight and flicked it on, setting it on the desk. Alec sat in the chair and pulled the box across the wooden surface. Inside, he found what he needed: pictures, magazines, all from a world he'd never known but wanted so badly. Alec had been born 3 months into the incursion, 25 years ago. He liked to think his parents had been joyful people, in love and excited at the thought of starting a family. He scanned through other people's long-forgotten photos, seeing birthday parties, school graduations, and weddings, everyone smiling in each of them. Those were what kept him going all these years. What was he doing, sneaking out at night to stare at memories of an Earth that would never be again? "Get it together," he whispered to himself. The thought of returning to the factory and doing it all again tomorrow, or today, judging by the moon, was enough to send a shiver of dread through his body. How long could he go on like this? He needed to leave, for good. He had to take Beth and escape Detroit. He'd heard rumors of a safe zone over the last 10 years, and it was time to put the gossip to the test. If only he could duplicate the technology on his wrist. Alec flicked the flashlight off and shoved the box to its original spot. It was time to go home. Each step was a challenge as he crossed the warehouse and marched outside. His heart hammered in his chest the moment the fresh air hit his lungs. The familiar whine of an active Seeker drone carried to his ears from above. 3. Lena.
"Don't give up,"
Lena whispered to the old man struggling up the steep hill.
"Not long to go until we can rest."
Her smile, a full set of white teeth showing against her coffee-colored skin and jet-black hair, shone bright and genuine. She hoped it would reassure him, make him forget the nagging pain in his chest and the agony of what they had left behind. Their safe home in the wooded hills of the huge reserve was all that remained of their people, so far as they knew. The 30 or so survivors fleeing the burning wreckage of their village were a mixture of old and young. In her 21st summer, Lena had worked as a healer since she was a child. Because she was a healer, because she was someone who people looked to for answers and reassurance, she stepped up to the plate. That was why, standing high on a wooded hill overlooking the valley where she'd been born, she smiled at the broken and frightened remnants of her entire people to portray a confidence she didn't feel. She'd been following the advice of the elders and knew that they must lead the people up out of the hidden valley and north until they reached the snow-capped mountains. The flames from far below frightened her and would haunt her dreams for as long as she lived. But her face never revealed that fear and loss in case it infected the others and put them at risk. She hitched up the heavy pack on her shoulder and stepped down to assist a woman struggling to carry a bag of hastily gathered belongings and a child under her other arm.
Lena,
a gruff voice said from behind her. She turned to see one of the village's warriors holding up a hand to her.
Caleb, she said, what's up?
One of the elders has fallen,
he told her.
How bad?
She says she cannot move her leg. It hurts her too much.
Lena bit her lip before answering.
Everyone needs to keep going, she said. We can't be on the side of the mountain after dark. It's too dangerous.
Where do you suggest we go?
Caleb asked. He was brave, of that there was no doubt, but when it came to strategy, he was a follower rather than a leader.
The old road should be over the crest,
she told him.
I have seen them before. Gather everyone to the shelter and I'll follow.
Caleb tried to argue, but she sent him away to look after the majority of their group. He went reluctantly, trying to sound reassuring as he encouraged them to speed up and leave the mountainside before night began to fall. Lena stepped carefully through the steep path until she found the old woman sitting with her back against a pine tree twice as wide as she was. She held onto her left ankle with both hands, her eyes squeezed tight in pain, her toothless mouth held in a silent scream.
It's okay,
Lena said soothingly, as she knelt beside the woman surrounded by her loved ones.
You're going to be okay.
She slipped off her pack and pulled out a cloth-wrapped bundle containing a neatly cut strip of cloth already soaked in lavender oil. The old woman hissed in pain as Lena slipped off her sandal and stretched the bandage to wrap it tightly around her swollen ankle with practiced hands. She reached into a pouch for a sprig of cut lavender, handing it to the woman, who took it silently and pressed it to her top lip before inhaling deeply, letting the soothing scent of the flowers calm her. Lena finished the bandage and slipped the remains of the plant into the pocket of the woman's coat.
You'll need to carry her,
she told the few people waiting around in nervous inactivity.
At least until we catch up with the others.
They all ducked instinctively as the whoosh of air and a high-pitched shriek passed far overhead. The fast-moving hovercraft was followed by two more as the rumbling sounds of distant explosions rolled up the mountain.
We need to move,
Lena said, thanking their luck that their group had moved when they did, and that the hovercrafts that came with the bombs must have been far enough away to allow for their people to flee. The woman was carried from the wet ground, her arms stretched over the shoulders of the two fittest to remain with her. The main group was out of sight by the time they'd restarted their upwards journey, and with fire and explosions below them and uncertainty up ahead, the climb was an arduous one. Screams and cries of alarm sounded from across the crest, making Lena and the group she'd returned for drop and press themselves flat onto the ground. She crawled on her belly, inching up the wet slope as her heart pounded fit to burst. The whine of an engine reached her brain before her eyes could take in the scene. The buildings beside the old road had long succumbed to the wind and time, but there was still valuable shelter to be found there. The rest of her people, almost all of the survivors of the world she had grown up a part of, were being corralled inside a circle of armed men and women. All of them wore stiff-looking uniforms, making them appear like they'd been made as part of a single batch, and pointed shining weapons at her people.
No,
she growled angrily, pushing herself up and preparing to run blindly to their aid and her unwitting fate. She never made it to her feet as the old woman with the sprained ankle grabbed Lena's boot and pulled her to the ground. Lena's face hit the damp earth and her mouth filled with dirt. The woman held a finger to her lips and pointed firmly at Lena. The old lady stabbed her finger at the rest of the group and then pointed off to the north through the trees. She said nothing, made no sound at all, but the wide-eyed stare of resolve made arguing a pointless exercise. Without looking at the younger men and women and the children, the woman forced herself to her feet and hobbled over the peak. Lena pressed her forehead to the ground for a second, hearing the stifled crying of people behind her, and turned to lead them away as she had just silently promised she would. She had no choice. It was the survival of some, or it was the destruction of all of them. Tears ran down the faces of the group as she threaded her way through the dense forest, as behind them the sound of screaming and the metallic twang of guns signaled death. Caleb bravely led his group onto the higher plain where the old road stood. He'd been up there as a child many times, never leaving the dense cover of the trees, but felt no such fear as he pushed ahead to show the survivors of his home the way. He stopped, waving an arm above his head to lead them into the dying light and towards the collection of low buildings where he envisioned them seeking safe shelter for the night. He didn't hear the rapidly descending hovercraft, but he did catch the tormented screams from the villagers who were caught in the open and exposed. Another hovercraft popped above the treetops, silent, until it emerged into open space. The shrieking whine of the engines tore through the air to drown out their cries. The ships sank to the ground, whipping up great clouds of pale red dust, which settled after the engines hushed to silence. The circular doors opened and ramps descended, spilling out two squads of uniformed humans who hefted bright metallic weapons and corralled the terrified people into a tightly huddled group. From each ship came one of them. Many of the older generation, those who'd been no more than young children when the invasion first began, had seen the aliens when they arrived. For many of the unfortunate souls who'd been born since, their first sight of the occupying force drew screams of terror and repulsion. One of the overseers walked slowly towards the group, showing only disgust and derision at the sight of so many uncatalogued, wild humans. It was tall, taller than any person Caleb had ever seen, and it walked with a curious gait that resembled a wading bird, knees bending backwards and thick, scaled skin covering the sinewy muscles. Long arms hung past its thin waist, lower than a human's would, and the pointed snout below, almond-shaped yellow eyes opened when its lips peeled back to reveal a double row of sharp, pointed teeth. It snarled something at the uniformed collaborators who began dragging people out from the fringes of the huddle and separating them under direction of the alien. It didn't take a genius to figure out that those separated were too old or infirm to be considered for breeding. The younger ones had a device pressed into the base of their skulls and became instantly compliant, shuffling up the ramps of the ships to their imprisonment and ultimate death. Many more would be assessed at the sprawling work camps and be found unfit to work or breed. They would all be killed in time. Those left behind huddled together to await their deaths, which came at the hands of their own kind, who opened fire on them without mercy, like they were exterminating vermin. 4. Dex. Dex rolled his window down, letting the chilled night air blow against his face. There wasn't much he enjoyed more than cruising the empty interstate at 2 in the morning, music blaring. The CD player still worked in his car, and he was careful to keep his favorites from scratching. He momentarily found himself wondering if anyone would ever make music again, and pushed the idle thought from his mind. He had bigger fish to fry. The classic rock song reached its crescendo, and Dex's foot pressed hard on the pedal, advancing down the roadway at an unsafe speed. He didn't care. There were no more police or highway patrol to stop him, and that was how he liked it. Occasionally, the roads would be busted open from wild vegetation, but a flat tire was a risk he took on each mission. To top it all off, the bastards had outfitted the engines with some contraption that made gasoline obsolete. It was some sort of renewable liquid they gave him to fill the tank with. He didn't quite understand the tubes flowing in and out of the hood to the undercarriage and didn't really care. It kept driving, and that in itself was a miracle.
"Where are you?"
He grabbed the folder from the leather passenger seat and opened it with one hand, looking away from the road for a second. He scanned the picture and saw the name on the bottom. Trent James. What kind of name was that, anyway? It sounded like an accountant, not a deserter rumored to be linked to the fabled uprising. He read the file notes and laughed. The guy was listed as an auditor. This was his fifth hunt over the past 6 weeks, and the overseers weren't happy about all the people escaping their camps. At least that was what Dex had been told by his boss. He never had direct contact with them, and that suited Dex just fine. The less those yellow eyes saw of him, the better his chances of surviving. The last four hunts had gone as they always did, with him dragging a body around inside his trunk. It was one of the reasons he drove the old Chevy, the trunk space. Plus, it went like a bat out of hell. He tossed the folder to the seat beside him, cranked the volume higher, and kept heading toward the full moon, hanging in the sky like an omen. An hour passed, and he slowed, seeing the sign indicating the exit for Creston, Iowa, another nowhere town in a nothing state. The overseers weren't set up in Iowa, which made it the perfect running grounds for defectors. The target's locator was last active here in Creston, but it hadn't moved in 3 days. That either meant he'd removed it or he was still there, hoping no one would put the energy into finding the worthless Trent James. Dex was batting 1,000 if he didn't count the few unfortunate instances sprinkled within the last 10 years, which he didn't because sometimes things happened that were out of his control. He took the exit into the small town. It appeared so much like every other settlement in that part of the United States, bland and dark. Streetlights were a thing of the past, and he cut his own car's lights as he turned onto the main road. The bright high moon cast enough glow to grant him safe passage. He pulled off to the side of the road and cut the engine. The last thing he wanted to do was rev his big block all the way around Main Street, alerting any roamers that he was there. He pulled the Glock from the glove box, shoved it into his holster strapped around his shoulder, and zipped his leather jacket around it. The night was colder than he'd expected without the warm air blowing gently through his vents. It was summer, but the area wasn't feeling the full effect quite yet.
"I should have waited until tomorrow," he muttered as he softly closed the car door.
He went to the trunk, pulled out his dart gun, and shoved it into his belt, careful to make sure the safety was on. You only shot yourself with a tranquilizer dart once. At least Dex hoped that was true. He reached through the passenger window, grabbed the photo of the target, and folded it, sliding the paper into his breast pocket. Not that it would be hard to remember that stunned look from the image. Dex headed toward town, his cowboy boots kicking up a light dust behind him. Nature had a way of reclaiming what once belonged to it when there was no one around to fight back. The asphalt was cracked everywhere, and small trees and shrubs grew randomly, especially near the edges of the road. Dex avoided those areas, walking directly down the middle of the street. Dex pulled a small device from his pocket, almost like the cell phone he used to have as a teenager. He grinned to himself, remembering the day his dad had given in and bought him one. He was finally able to stop being a social pariah and was soon on social media like every normal kid. 3 months later, the overseers came, wreaking havoc on the world. Dex never really understood the point of it anyway. He tapped the device to life and selected Trent's name. The icon blinked 5 blocks from his position, still not moving. Dex would be there in no time. The guy was probably sleeping. This was going to be an easy one. He entered the main street. He could swear he had just been in this town, but that place had been in Missouri, not Iowa. Everything looked the same. Post office, sheriff's station, grocery store, and, of course, a diner. His stomach growled at the thought of a greasy grilled cheese and fries. That used to be his favorite. As a hunter, he was given more freedom than anyone else, but he rarely found any deep-fried food. He peered at the grocery store, then at the device, before shoving the small metal rectangle into his jeans pocket. Trent James didn't seem to be going anywhere. There was enough time for a pit stop. Dex tried the door and found it was locked, chains wrapped tightly through the push bars on the inside of the glass entryway. No way in, not unless he broke the glass, letting anyone in the area know of his presence. Instead, he headed around to the rear of the building where an overhead bay door sat a foot or two off the loading dock. Perfect.
What am I doing?
He asked himself quietly as he lay on the concrete and rolled through the opening. It was pitch black, and Dex pulled the same device out, hitting the flashlight feature before snapping it to his jacket. A soft glow illuminated in front of him, and he blinked to acclimatize to the brightness after the utter darkness. He wasn't prepared for what he saw, and he stumbled backwards, hitting the aluminum bay door with a thud. 2 bodies hung from the warehouse rafters, their necks broken. The skeletons, evidence this happened a long time ago. Another body lay sprawled on the floor beneath them, a hole in the skull. Tattered clothing clung to the form where the rodents hadn't eaten it. Dex wondered if it was the wife or the mother that came to find her loved ones hanged before she shot herself. Everyone had dealt with Earth's new situation differently. Some had managed, and others had done things like this. He stepped past the woman, not letting himself feel anything but disgust at what they'd done to themselves. Nothing was going to make Dex feel bad about his decisions. Sure, he worked for the overseers, but he was surviving, and not in the slave fields or factories like all the others. He kept moving, heading for the front of the store. It had been pillaged, but not as bad as a lot of the stores he'd been to. The town must have been cleared quickly 25 years ago. Anything that could go bad would have decayed a long time ago, but certain things were usable. Dex licked his dry lips as he made for the liquor aisle. Most of it was gone, the shelves picked clean, but he noticed something on the top overstock shelf.
Bingo.
He pulled a step stool down the aisle and reached for the box. It was pressed against the rear of the top shelf, and its weight told Dex it was full. The name on the side of the cardboard almost brought a tear to his eye. Whiskey. A full case of whiskey. He almost opened it there, but stopped himself. He had a job to do, and he wasn't good to anyone if he was passed out in a grocery store with dead people hanging from the ceiling. Dex placed it near the front door and kept searching. The cans would be rancid, but he found a few first aid kits, which he took. He rationed things like that, but he liked to keep backups. Behind the customer service counter, he saw countless lottery scratch tickets and a pack of matches. He took the matches and noticed a single carton of cigarettes sitting under a newspaper. They were his brand, too. What were the odds? The carton was wrapped in plastic, and he tugged it open. When was the last time he'd smoked one of these? 5 years? Even when they'd been so old, they tasted like smoking a dried-out sock. Still, thinking about the burning sensation as the smoke passed through his throat and into his lungs was enough to make him grab a pack, remove the foil, and pull one of the cigarettes out, placing it between his lips. He feigned an inhale on the unlit butt and smiled. This would do just fine. He left it unlit and took the carton. Dex spent another 10 minutes searching for anything of value and exited with a bag of supplies on top of the whiskey and cigarettes. He unraveled the chain on the front entrance, the metal links sliding to the ground with a clatter. Dex opened the door, set his supplies on the sidewalk, and marched toward his target. He stopped in his tracks at an unfamiliar sound. He held his breath and listened, hard. A coyote howled in the distance. Good. Coyotes wouldn't try to shoot you. He'd returned for the whiskey and smokes when James was hogtied. Dex would drive there, stopping as a reward for a job well done. The icon showed he was 2 blocks from Trent James's chip, and that was where he headed, turning east after the diner. The windows were smashed, and a dirty old sign claimed Dorothy's Diner had the state's best hamburger. Dex doubted that had ever been true. He cut his light, opting to go in dark. Dex stopped at the parking lot entrance. The place looked like a hockey arena from his vantage point. He checked the device one last time for good measure, its softly lit screen glowing green against his face. His target was in there, all right. Dex unholstered the Glock and felt better the instant the metal touched his palm. It was a crappy world out there, and not much made him feel as safe as when he was armed. His footsteps felt too loud on the way to the entrance, and he lifted his boots to keep them from dragging on the gravel lot. He wouldn't let himself think about the whiskey, or the cigarettes, or the fact that this was his 5th hunt in a row, and if he brought the guy back alive, he was owed a week of R&R. He needed it, too. It was nice having the freedom to roam around, but he knew he was pressing his luck every time he went out on the road. Most hunters didn't last 5 years. He'd spent double that chasing the poor saps with enough balls to make a run for it. Dex tested the door and found it wasn't even locked. What an amateur. Dex found so many things done wrong by the people he hunted. If he was going to do it, he'd... Shut up, Dex, he whispered to himself. He knew the overseers couldn't read his thoughts, but he didn't want that kind of idea wandering around his mind. It wouldn't end well. He pulled the glass door open, the white lettering so worn he couldn't make out the arena's hours of operation. He almost laughed to himself and stepped into the big dark building. The device showed James in the southwest corner, all the way across the place. Dex took his time, careful not to step on anything or make noise. There were a few hockey bags spread out on the black rubber tiles. It didn't take long to find the room James was hiding in. Dex saw the icon blinking on the screen and tucked it away into his pocket. It was lucky number 5. After turning his light on, he pressed the push bar and flung the door open with his gun raised. Freeze! He shouted, unsure why he always used the old cop lingo. It was corny, but usually did the job. The room lay empty, his voice falling flat against the stark white cinderblock walls. What the hell? He crept into the space and saw sticks lining the walls. Skates hung on in neat little rows. In the rear stood a skate sharpening machine. That was when he spotted the blood. Crap, he muttered, finally seeing the whole picture. It wasn't the first time he'd seen someone chop off their own hand to get rid of the locator chip, but it was the first time it had been done with a skate blade. The hand remained on the floor, cut 2 inches above the wrist. That would have hurt. A lot. Deck scanned for any clues and saw the section of gauze stuck to the blade beside him. If James had done this to himself, there was a good chance he would have passed out nearby. It was going to be a long night. He exited the building and heard the whirring of the seeker drones. Not so worried about noise now, he ran through downtown, continuing until he found his car. There was no way he was letting the seekers notify the trackers that they found his target. This was his catch. And the only way to ensure the overseers kept human hunters alive was by being better than their damned robots. The drone would know he was a hunter by his chip, so he wasn't worried about them sending the deadly trackers against him, but that was when things became a free-for-all. Their violent programming tended to be indiscriminate. Dex ripped down the main street, wistfully eyeballing the case of whiskey before heading out behind the arena.
5. Cole. He ran. Cole had barely stopped for 3 days until he stumbled into the tumbled-down stones of a historic monument. His legs pumped for hours at a time on the first day, feeling exposed and completely vulnerable moving in the daylight, but he knew the difference between life and death meant putting distance between himself and the point where the trackers would begin their hunt. He crossed the river twice, both times walking as far to the north as he could before the water became too deep or the current too strong. Cole used every trick he'd ever been taught and more he'd learned the hard way in the years of wandering the country alone. He climbed the fire escape of a building which still had 4 floors surviving under the burned-out roof before carefully breaking a window to make it look like he'd gotten inside, then crossing the perilous gap to the neighboring building to climb down and head away in another direction. When he reached a smaller tributary late that first day, he ran in and out of the water and up both banks for varying distances before returning to the brook and repeating the process on the other side. When he'd spent as long as he dared, he went upstream as far as he could manage before climbing out and jogging down a dusty path that had once been a road. Cole was worried that his wet boots and clothes would leave a trace, but when he glanced behind him, he saw what the fierce sunlight did to the damp footprints as they visibly shrank away. The first night he tucked himself into a narrow gap between 2 heavy dumpsters in an alley. He sat on his pack and hugged the shotgun with a square of old dark green plastic covering his hiding place. His ears stayed tuned to the frequency that would give him advanced warning of any pursuit, and the stress of the day's action fought against the energy he had expended to keep him awake until the sun set and the temperature dropped to make the dried film of sweat itch his skin. He didn't cry. Cole hadn't cried in as long as he could recall, even when he'd lost the only people close to him in the entire world. He closed his eyes and slept lightly, ready to run again if he needed to. The morning brought with it a cool sunlight and an uncomfortably full bladder. He stood, neatly folded the poncho, and placed it into the top of his bag, which he swung up onto his shoulders. He glanced nervously around the alley with his ears on high alert as he unzipped and watered the dusty concrete. His eyes stung from the strong smell of ammonia, which served as a warning to find more water. He had 3 bottles filled from the river the day before, all old and worn, but blessedly free from leaks, and he drank deeply from one to quench his thirst. He leaned on a dumpster as the cold water hit his empty stomach and made him feel faint. He shook his head to clear the fog of hungry exhaustion before reaching into a side pocket of his battered backpack for a strip of dried meat and a handful of berries. He pulled on his pack again, jaw working the tough strips of the small deer that had sustained him for well over a week. Stepping carefully to the far end of the alleyway, he stopped and listened for a full minute, turning his head up to the sky and closing his eyes to block any distractions. It was his hearing that had saved his life more times than he could count. His hearing that had given him enough time to escape or to hide from the drones scouring the open, empty countryside for others like him. When he was satisfied that there was nothing searching the area for him, he moved on. The trackers would be following his trail,
Or at least, he had to assume they were to stay alive, but he hoped that his obstacle course of ploys to throw them off his scent would delay them by at least a day or more. He traveled west, away from the more built-up areas he saw to the east, despite his natural urge to head towards the buildings for cover. Thinking there might be other people hunting him, he chose the opposite path to try and avoid being predictable. By the time he reached the next large collection of buildings, the sun was starting to oppress him with its warmth, but the breeze carried enough pace to keep him from getting hot. He spent a long time listening again, checking for the telltale whine of drones, until he was satisfied that he was alone in the area. He found a place to stay, selecting it carefully for its lack of large windows that would allow him to have a fire but still have ventilation. He chewed the last of the deer jerky as he searched the place for anything useful. A partially used spool of thin wire, a spray can of lubricant with a flammable warning on it, a wire rack that he cleaned off to use as a cooking plate, a cap he placed tentatively on his head but put it back as it was too big. A small set of pliers and a heavy wrench were added to his kit, replacing smaller and more worn versions. Cole laid out all his equipment and clothing, upgrading where he needed to and cleaning and mending all that he had, changing his clothes to wash them in a barrel half full of rainwater after he had scooped off the layer of scum floating on top. He hung them to dry over some patio furniture in the sun. Hanging them on a line to dry in the breeze would be as sensible as having a large fire in the open, as nothing really announced the presence of a person more than fresh laundry. Maybe fresh was an overstretch, but without running water nearby to wash them properly, he had to make do and at least stop them from stinking up his pack. Wearing fresh clothes, he meticulously cleaned every facet of the shotgun and set out with his bag repacked, minus the drying garments. Having learned the hard way that he should never leave his equipment anywhere he couldn't grab it and run at the first sign of danger. It felt alien for him to be out and moving in the daylight, but his rhythm had been turned upside down by the drones finding him. He knew he'd stayed there at least 2 days too long, but he was still tired from the fever that had hit him hard a couple of weeks earlier. A flock of pigeons took off from a patch of open ground, and he set a spring trap nearby. Bending a sapling from the overgrown trees, he looped a snare of twisted twine around a careful construction of twigs before delicately dropping a few of the wilting berries from his pack into the trap. He repeated the process twice more, having learned never to rely on only one source of food, and made his way to his temporary home. He found a rack of old coats, laying them beside his pack for a mattress, before returning to the yard and collecting dried wood from a pile that had been cut years before. It was bone dry, eaten by insects, making it lighter than it looked, but it would burn well enough. Tiredness overtook him that afternoon, putting him into a deeper sleep than he liked as he felt exposed, and he woke after nightfall. Creeping outside, he checked his traps, painstakingly retrieving the loops of twine from the two empty traps before finding the third full, with a dove hanging from the makeshift noose. He muttered to himself happily as he unraveled the dead bird from the trap and took great care to scuff away any sign of human activity before cradling the small animal in his hand. Cole made a contained fire, rubbing the fire lighter against the edge of his worn knife to create sparks against the small ball of insulation pulled from one of the coats he sat on. He had sprayed the ball with a little of the lubricant oil, which helped it catch quickly, before he added the tiny twigs used in the traps to nurture the flame. As the fire settled, he used his knife to open up his dinner and cut away the meat from the breast and legs, which he laid out on the mesh tray. He picked every last scrap of flesh from the miniature carcass and carefully burned the body and feathers of the dove in parts, not wanting to make the flames too large or the smell too offensive. After he'd licked his fingers clean of the meat juice, He doused the fire and scuffed away the other signs of his presence before tightening the straps of his bag and heading north once more. On the third day after fleeing the drones, and with no sign of pursuit, he stepped over the scorched, pale stones of a very old, low wall. Being inside the compound, no matter how open it was, made him feel safer, somehow. He searched the area in the glow of moonlight and found an old rusted sign welcoming him to some kind of military museum, unable to shake the feeling that he was being watched. 6. Alec. Alec slowly closed the door as he moved inside the warehouse. How could he be so foolish to think the bracelet from Tom would actually work? The Seekers were the first line from the Overseers. They were always seen hovering in the sky, day and night, looking for anything out of the ordinary, and, more specifically, roamers. From what Alec knew, they would scan you, retrieve your ID, and if you were in an unauthorized region, they'd notify the